Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hi, I'm Mitch Skinner, and tonight we're hopping on the last train to Clarksville.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Noel Clark.
Now, my friend, if you'll sit quietly for one moment, I'll have a look at you. Well, stay still, will you? Well, how can I?
Questionable fashion choices aside, spring marks a time of change. But she overcomes adversity and becomes a wizard anyway, and like one of the three great wizards of her peer group, you know?
Thanks for joining. One of the largest problems with working at a college radio station is the high degree of turnover. Most of us are only here for 4 years, and then we're gone, and the new guard takes over. Tonight, we're spotlighting the best work from one of the finest members of the old guard, former host Noel Clark. We'll take a trip to the Southern Theater to check out a rock opera. We'll try to experience the world the way blind people do. And we're heading back to camp. It's all coming up next on Culture Q. But first, one of our producers will tell you just what made Noel so special.
Noel was a man of many talents. First off, whistling. He had a mean whistle. You could always hear him coming down the hall because the whistle would just echo. But that's not all. He also had really, really good taste in YouTube videos. He actually, he introduced me to what is today my favorite YouTube video on all of YouTube, which is Roomba Cat. That came from Noel. But above all, he's a fantastic producer. And at midnight when I'm in the studio and I just can't go on anymore, it's usually his stories that I listen to in order to kind of give me inspiration and keep finishing my story and to answer the question, what should a story look like? His critiques, which are always right on, and his examples of stories, and just his profound understanding of sound in general has really helped me over the last year. Oh, and as a side note, from what I've seen in the office, his wife makes really good food. Don't you wonder
sometimes about some vision? Being a man covered from neck to ankle in tattoos, there's probably no better place Noel Clark fit in than here at Radio K. But it was more than just appearances. He always seemed to find that perfect balance between art and rock and roll. Like when he reported on Dying to Make It, a rock opera here in the Twin Cities.
Ted Martin and Rob Schwartz are getting ready for a night at the opera. But this isn't Don Giovanni or the Barber of Seville. This is Dying to Make It, a rock opera about life and death in the music business. The show is brought to life at the Southern Theater by a cast of 13 Minnesota-based musicians, all of whom have worked together in one way or another in the local scene. In Ted's studio, a dark purple basement sanctuary filled with guitars, amps, and recording gear, Rob fills us in on the story so far.
It's about a young guy who has been playing rock and roll for a while with the band, and he kind of goes off on his own. And in the moment that he signs the solo contract, he gets a little wasted and crashes his motorcycle. And that all happens in the first song. Rock and roll, the fire takes his life. Rock and roll.
Rock and roll, the fire takes his life. From that point on, the story takes place in purgatory.
The rest of Dying to Make It follows Paul's voyage from the void back to the world of the living. The choices he makes along the way will influence whether or not he stays and goes to hell or returns to his girlfriend on the other side.
It's a rock show, but it tells a story.
Rob, who plays the lead character, Paul Lime, explains.
It's going to be a pretty spare set. We want to have a video projection on the wall to kind of show where we are in the show. So you kind of get a feel for kind of, whether he's in the club or a studio, you know, those kind of things. And those, the Southern is set up to do that.
Well, that's really the thing.
Ted Martin, who plays the appropriately named guitarist Tommy in Dying to Make It, scouted the site. Here's Ted.
The Southern Theater, being the theater it is, it really is also the additional cast member, because it looks like it should for this production. I mean, it's very exposed brick and deteriorating. The arch, the proscenium arch is deteriorating in there, so it gives you that look of what we're imagining Purgatory to be, which is very urban and very, you know, destructed.
It's almost serendipitous that the Southern Theater and Dying to Make It found each other. The Southern Theater itself was on the verge of collapse after financial woes caused the staff to be reduced to one lone person.
My name is Damon Runnels, and I am the general manager of the Southern Theater.
I met with Damon at the Southern, and he told me about what caused these two forces to come together.
One of the interesting things about the Southern now is we're no longer curating work. So in many ways, the ability for Dying to Make It to be here is a result of the fact that we are now a subsidized access facility.
While Damon may not be in purgatory, the success of the theater rests on his shoulders. I asked him how much of a heavy burden that was.
It's been very challenging, but it's also been very fulfilling. So when we reduced our staff down to one last June due to the financial constraints that the Southern was going through, you know, we were in a severe position where the building might close last April, May, and June. We really didn't know what the future held. I'm very happy with the work that we've done. We've taken care of a lot of our debts around town. We have rebuilt an organization that is more transparent and leaner than it's ever been. I come in, I'm happy to come here, I'm happy to keep this place open and keep it accessible, and it shows like Dying to Make It and the ability to support Nani Dance Theater, who's over at the university. I mean, these groups rely on the space to be available. There's nothing that is stopping you. Southern is a beautiful, beautiful space. It's a, you know, 101-year-old crumbling interior. You can't manufacture that. It's, you know, it's all natural destruction over the years. It's, you know, they couldn't have picked a more perfect backdrop, and I think people will really resonate with those two elements of the story that they're telling and the world that they're drawing from and the space that it's in.
So if you've ever found yourself wondering, should I go to a rock show or go see the theater? Why not do both at the same time and watch both the Southern Theater and Dying to Make It claw their way back from the abyss to the glorious light of rock? For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
When I was putting together the show, Noel asked me what stories I would use. I explained to him that I wanted to recap his best stories, but I also wanted to represent the vast scope of stories he told. Noel said that he did a lot of stories about food, and I should use one of those. And he's right. Here's a story about some Cajun cuisine.
Mardi Gras, or Fat Tuesday, is the day before French Catholics in the South began fasting for Lent. In New Orleans, this means food. Cajun and Creole cuisine erupted in the South when cooking styles of French colonialists and locals merged.
It's really a Creole cooking itself is a hodgepodge of probably five different cooking cultures. Now, New Orleans itself was basically a French city.
This is Ben McCallum. He's the executive chef at Three Sons Catering in South Minneapolis.
So they have a very heavy base in it, and you'll see that through all styles. There's a lot of frying, there's a lot of dough batters, and the crustings and the cuts that you see are basically French.
Several times a year, Ben teaches cooking classes at Kitchen Window in Uptown Minneapolis. The name of this class is Mardi Gras Dinner Party.
I'm going to add some red onion again. See a little.
The menu consists of fried catfish, crawfish fritters, sweet potato and hominy hash, and collard greens. At the center of all this is what Ben refers to as the Holy Trinity.
Holy Trinity of New Orleans cooking and most Southern style cooking is green peppers, celery, and onions. It's used in 90% of all cooking as a base. Whereas in French cooking, it's a mirepoix, which is carrots, celery, and onions. So really, they've taken that base French again and added a pepper to it. A green pepper usually is what is in there to add, you know, a bite to it. And they omit the carrots because it's a little harder to cook. It doesn't stew as well.
Ben's love of cooking developed at an early age.
Well, my father was an executive chef, so the first thing I was really doing was peeling vegetables and learning how to do basic knife cuts.
Though trained classically in the French style, Ben considers himself more of a fusion chef.
Anytime that I do a southern meal, I'm really delving into the roots of a French Creole style cooking. And I think that's kind of prevalented out from New Orleans itself and Louisiana, and it's surrounded the area with that style of cooking.
A style that itself relies heavily on improvisation, spices, seafood, and the need for a filling meal. For example,
a really great jambalaya, you know, a dish that is saucy, spiced but not spicy, served over a rice that's usually a little more bland to offset the spice. That's what I would really see as, like, if you went down there and you were going to go to somebody's house and eat something, they're probably going to be serving you a jambalaya. And everyone's jambalaya is different, you know, it depends on what's in your pantry at the time.
For you Midwesterners with empty pantries and no hope to get down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras this year, don't fret. You only need to go as far as downtown Minneapolis.
I'm Jonathan Flatt. I'm head chef at the Bullfrog Cajun Bar.
The menu at the Bullfrog has a heavy emphasis on Cajun food. But if frog legs and crawfish aren't your forte, don't worry, you won't starve.
We do a lot of classic Cajun and Creole food, and in addition to a lot of different kinds of burgers and stuff that's bar food, it's accessible to everyone.
Having lived in New Orleans, Jonathan knows what it's like to miss home. That's why he provides a little bit of it to his customers.
I really like comfort food. It's kind of like I want to inspire memories. Like, so the highest compliment I can get is someone saying that, oh, that meal just reminded me of a meal I had when I was down there or was living down south.
Downtown working folk might be wondering where they fit in. Don't worry, they have po' boys.
Shrimp po' boy and catfish po' boy, probably those two are huge sellers here.
The catfish po' boy is huge. I definitely, I had one and it was a lot of food.
Awesome. Yeah, it is quite a bit of food and we kind of try to fill people up.
Jonathan's not content to stop there. The Bullfrog's menu is ever expanding, so if you're in the mood for that jambalaya, well, here it comes.
We're definitely going to add some jambalaya and some etouffee and some more classic Cajun and Creole dishes.
Whether you're trying your hand at cooking at home or just going out to have some food in the town, no meal is complete without good tunes.
I do like some Dixieland jazz, Louis Armstrong, stuff like that.
Jazz all the way.
Again, Ben McCallum.
Something with horns, something with a nice sax in the background, but it's got to be, you know, it's got to be pumping at the same time. It can't be the slow jazz that you would think of when you turn to a jazz station. It's got to be a lively, almost ska-ish type of jazz.
After just stuffing your face with so much food that you want to burst, go dance it off. That is, after all, the spirit of Mardi Gras. For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
Noel was a great Culture Q boss, sure, but he was also a nifty DJ. That's what my earliest memories of him are about. As I was in training to become a DJ myself, I was assigned to audit one of his shifts, and I remember being in awe of what was going on in the studio and thinking to myself, how is it possible for him to keep the live set going, operate all of the computer systems, and maintain an upbeat conversation with not one but two newbies, as well as other radio K-ers popping into the studio? What I experienced that time is just as true today. Noel has some serious multitasking skills, and luckily, he isn't afraid to push the limit. Whether he's wearing the hat of a DJ, a reporter, or host and managing editor of Culture Q, or whatever spectacular things he will move on to from here, concluding from what he likes to talk about, I guess what keeps him grounded is that at the end of the day, he's just a generously tattooed silver fox, loving his wife, his cat, and his life. Oh, and he's got a Chuck Norris beard.
Obviously, sound is pretty important to making good radio, but sometimes even we here at Culture Q take it for granted. Not Noel, though. He always seemed to know how he wanted to make you feel when you were listening to one of his pieces. In this next sound-rich story, Noel Clark tries to experience Minneapolis without a sense of sight.
Wait!
The world can be a noisy place. From talking traffic signs and passing cars to hallway conversations and high heels.
Computers.
For one reason,
at least that's what I'd say.
For people like 20-year-old Jordan Strom, navigating this auditory ocean requires special skills.
I was born blind.
For sighted people, everyday sounds sometimes take a backseat to vision. But these are important to Jordan for a few reasons.
Well, there are two issues that come up.
This is Bert.
Hi, my name's Bert Schlau, and I'm a professor in speech-language hearing sciences.
First, we need to... Well, I'll let Bert explain.
One of them is how a person who's blind is able to navigate and know what objects are in the environment without seeing them. What some do is produce clicks or they'll bang a cane. What that does is it causes the different frequencies to bounce off of objects.
When our ears receive these sounds, they receive them at two different times. For example, a sound from the right reaches the right ear first, and the left ear second, because of the diameter of the head.
We have cells within our brainstem that are able to assess these differences to within a millionth of a second.
A millionth of a second might not seem like much, but for Jordan, it's this brain function that allows him to determine his location in relation to other objects in space.
Buildings I can pick up from the echo. So if there's a building to the right and I hear an echo, I can usually estimate the distance based off of that.
But distance isn't the only spatial consideration the brain takes into account. Size is also a factor.
We also use information about the overall timbre of the sound. And we can judge how big or small a room is by the sounds of the echoes.
Timbre is the quality a sound has that distinguishes it from other sounds. But the ability to differentiate these sounds is inherent in most people.
Even if you were to blindfold someone who has vision within normal limits, they could tell whether they were in a big or a small room based on the echoes that come back.
At Vision Loss Resources on the corner of Franklin and Lindale in Uptown, I get the chance to put this to the test.
Yeah.
Just keep it like that. Let's try it with the blindfold.
Okay.
VLR is a resource for people with low or no vision, as well as the sighted. Training sessions such as this are designed for individuals with declining vision to instruct them on how to remain mobile once their sight is gone.
Okay, I just make sure that you don't hit anything. The cane will hit it.
It's 7 a.m. on a brisk Wednesday morning, and I'm about to step out onto one of the busiest streets in South Minneapolis, blindfolded.
All right, we'll go straight ahead, find the door.
Okay.
There you go. Walk right up to it. Find it with your hand and then push. And then we'll do it for the second door as well.
Straight ahead as well?
Correct. Make a right turn.
The 10 minutes it takes me to walk around the block and back to the front door of VLR is only a fraction of what your average, relatively mobile blind person might experience in a day.
Handrail?
Okay.
Being deprived of sight and having to rely on only my ears to guide me, the cane in front of me, and the way the ground feels under my feet is a terrifying yet liberating experience. However, sound and the cane alone aren't for everyone.
It's right out there and it makes you look blind. I liked what a dog could give a person as far as mobility.
This is Sam Jasmine. To her side sits Jenny, her guide dog.
And people, you know, have interesting reactions to, you know, canes and disabilities, and depending on how much knowledge they have about the situation.
So for a half an hour once a week, Sam creates her own world of audio sounds on KFAI, a local community radio station.
My show is Disabled and Proud, and it's all on disability topics.
Wading through this world of sound can be a difficult thing, but just knowing that people like Sam and Jordan are out there to help makes it a little less scary.
How do you relate to other people with low vision or no vision? Like if I had just lost my sight and I was very frustrated or upset, like what would you say?
I would tell them that you're not completely stuck, you're not helpless. There is accommodations you can get, and you're gonna make it through the world, because I got this far. Millions of other people have that are blind and visually impaired. You're just gonna have to get used to learning things a new way and adapting to them.
For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
My name is Markita Fornoff, and I'm a producer here at Culture Q. And I've actually worked with Noel Clark ever since he started here at the radio station, which makes me slightly embarrassed to admit that the first time Noel walked into our studio, I thought he was a professional. See, at Radio K, we're very fortunate to have connections to people in the professional world to the point where they'll come in and share advice or knowledge with us. And so I thought maybe I had just missed some sort of memo and Noel was like a guest speaker for us that night. I mean, it wasn't like the hair or his beard or the fact that we very clearly fill out different age bubbles on surveys. Noel just seemed to walk into the studio knowing exactly what he was doing. He had all of these story ideas right away, and he always seemed to be able to know a source for anything that someone else was working on. And he got all of the obscure pop culture references that still go over my head. As a volunteer and as a host, Noel just made stuff happen. So thank you for everything you've done, and best of luck with everything you're about to do.
For one of his final acts as host, Noel Clark organized a live-to-tape broadcast at the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis. But that wasn't the first time Noel took interest in our younger audience. This next story spotlights a camping workshop.
Welcome to I Can Camp. My name's Nick, and I'll be your instructor for the workshop, and I'm really excited to have you guys here.
It's 10 a.m. on a bright Saturday morning, and workshop instructor Nick Cox welcomes six families to Crow Wing State Park, their home for the next 24 hours. First order of business is tent setup.
We're going to take out what I think is the funnest thing to put together with our tents, our tent poles. There should be four tent poles in each one. There are two silver poles. And before you guys get going with these, I'm going to show you...
While the adults fumble with poles and rig up rain flies, Nick gets the children's attention with an activity designed to teach them how to identify animals in the wild.
I knew it! A rain fly!
Wolf!
Yeah, wolf. It's a white coyote.
For sure.
Do you guys want to learn what each of these are?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to set them on the tarp.
This is really shiny. I don't know why they...
Once camp is set up, campers are welcome to participate in any number of outdoor activities, such as hiking, fishing, photo scavenger hunts, or just relaxing with the family in the park.
So I wrote down the first coordinates, and the way...
Teresa Bazak and her son Drew decide to go geocaching. Campers plug a set of coordinates into a GPS unit that takes them to various scenic locations in the park. 2 hours and four sets of coordinates later, Teresa and Drew find their cache.
Oh yeah, look at that. We found it.
Geocachers are able to trade a trinket they brought with them for one that's already inside the box.
Just, see? Some stuff in there.
Drew trades a pig-shaped shoelace charm for a plastic Pikachu toy. This might not seem like a huge accomplishment, but the goal of the ICANN program is to get families to spend time together outdoors, away from the TV and video games. Nick says that for him, the most rewarding part of the experience is watching families bond in the woods.
I love hearing, "I want to go camping again." A lot of the people that come through this program have not done things that I took for granted when I was growing up. Like last year, there were kids that said the only fishing they've ever done was on a video game before, and I got to take them fishing for their first time. I've taught people how to make s'mores for the first time. That is a really big reward.
Circled around the campfire with roasting sticks in hand is the Moore family.
Mary.
Kathy.
Christy.
Kieran.
And?
Nick.
What are you doing, Nick?
I'm roasting some marshmallows.
What are you going to make with them?
S'mores!
Yeah!
I've got a little stockpile here if anyone's hungry. Oh my.
Jayapa Kotage is one of a group of three Indian families who are camping for their first time.
It's really like awesome. We loved it. And like it's so much enjoyable and like it's a pleasure to meet with all of you guys. Like cross-cultural and then like a very good atmosphere. Like, yeah, it's a mix and match.
Jayapa says that he brought the family camping to get away from the long hours he puts in at work.
I've been in the United States like from past 7 years, but like this is my first camping, and I really feel like why I missed like all these days, like this kind of campings.
At the other end of the table, a group of little girls eat curried kebabs and beam about their favorite parts of the trip as the adults cook popcorn over the fire.
My name is Samix. The best thing I did today is...
eating.
No. I saw a deer.
My name is Lashna. My best thing is saw baby deer.
My name is Sucha, and my best part was... looking out at the top of the car while coming here.
I saw you as you were coming here. You were making a lot of noise out the top of the car.
In the morning, as Nick and his campers pack up, they make an effort to protect the environment by leaving no trace behind. According to the DNR, the program is working. With attendance increasing every year, more campers will now have the skills to bring them back to the woods.
I'm sure you're tired.
And a few good stories to boot. For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
Take the skyway high above the busy little one way. In my stupid hat and gloves at night, I lie awake wondering if I'll sleep. Wondering if we'll.
And that's it for tonight's Culture Cue.
To take the skyway.
Tonight, you heard stories from Noel Clark. Special thanks to Amy Friedman, Maya Maravu-Pero, and Marquita Fornoff for providing anecdotes about Noel. Next week, it's our Father's Day episode, so make sure you find the right tie. Producers for Culture Q are Marquita Fornoff, Amy Friedman, and Matt Curtis. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and I'm Mitch Skinner. Culture Q is online at RadioK.org. We can also be found on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, we'll be back on your radio next Sunday at 6 p.m. We'll see you then.
Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.